reflect what it meant to them to see on the telly Irish women standing on Henry Street, standing up for their rights as they were school children in South Africa and being denied their rights.
And I think that the big thing, you know, it is, I won't say it's a forgotten part of our history, but it's a not taught part of our history. And if you go to South Africa, the Dunstore strikers are history. In a big way, they are part of South African history. And we need to start showing the respect in this country that those women deserve for the stance they took.
Not only that, but I'd also say we need to use them as an inspiration to this generation.
Absolutely. You can do it.
Yeah, you can change the world. Yeah. And these women made a difference. And it's a powerful... these people, they're just, it was an honour to get to sit there. Yeah,
absolutely. Thanks, Dave. Mean that, Dave. Thanks very much. Yeah. Really enjoyed that.
And I hope you all enjoy it. Talk to you all soon. Take care.
Thanks for coming back, folks. I hope everybody had a few sandwiches. There's still one or two there, and I can see some people putting them in their handbags there.
Did you bring yours?
My handbag. Look, when Dave asked, myself and Martin do a small podcast called The Echo Chamber, and we were asked kindly by Dave to come and speak to these fine ladies here. It was kind of a bit overwhelming at first, and now it's worse when you're actually sitting here in a room full of people, but nonetheless, I want to go back to what Bernadette said earlier. And I actually told Martin this, and she ruined my intro, because she spoke, as we all spoke, about solidarity. And I remember speaking to another person who speaks about solidarity a lot, Father Peter Mac, very recently, and he's made the point that in Ireland we're great at solidarity, but we're useless at compassion. And what he said was, the same hand that writes a check to homeless services signs a petition to say no family hub in my backyard. And he said that was the difference, was moving from solidarity to action. And there's no better example of women who actually stood up and took action than these women who were joined on stage by. So can I have a quick round of applause just to open for
Thanks very much. Just to make sure that we all know, like, there was one other man that came on strike, but it's the same time, which is Tommy Davis, and he's not here today. And then October, that was 84 when we came out in October, 85, Brendan Barron went on strike in Crumlin. So the majority of us are women, all right, but there was a man very much involved on that picket line, which is Tommy. And Brendan is here, which is great. My name is Karen Gearon, and I was the shop steward back in Dunstores in Henry Street. We received the union instruction to refuse to handle South African goods. I have up here beside me is Catherine O'Reilly, Liz Deasy, Michelle Gavin, Ní Sherlock, or Sherlock Ní Gavin, and Mary Manning. When we received the union instruction in July of 84, we knew very little about South Africa. As a matter of fact, we couldn't even pronounce the word apartheid, never mind spell it. So we followed it as a union instruction, and we were following it for 2 days. Michelle actually refused to handle South African goods, and she got a warning from Dunstores to say if she did it again, she could be suspended. And then that fateful day on the 19th of July, 1984, Mary, Alma and myself were on a register. And this woman was coming up, and I swear to God, every one of us was praying they wouldn't come to us. And they went to Mary, and fair play to Mary, said no, and she stuck by it. And the strike started at about 20 past 12 on a Thursday, and it was only to last 2 weeks, according to our very, very good friend, Brendan Archibald. It's the only lie the man ever told us. And then the strike developed into something much more. Had the union instructed us not to go back to work or to go back to work and handle the goods, we wouldn't have done it. And I know it's 35 years ago, but we were all only about 5 when it started. So I think you know who we are, so I'm going to bring it back to yourself to ask questions or whatever.
I suppose we jump straight in and go back into Ireland in 1984 was a very different place, and also not so different than some of the things that we're hearing more recently around immigration and scaremongering. But you were basically accused of race traitors. Was it scary to see the level of racism that actually underpinned some of this vitriol that you received on the picket line?
I don't know if we were accused of that, but what we were certainly, we would never have met a black person. The first black person we ever met was Nimrod Sajaka. Yeah. We would see the very, very singular black person who was probably a doctor or something in the medical profession. So we had no encounter of a different race. You know, in Ireland of 1984, there was a very, very bad recession. I remember there was a bin strike not long before we came out, or during our strike as well. And we were ordinary working class women and men. And, you know, for us to have a job, we were actually one of the lucky ones, you know, because our friends and other people were gone off and left the country or unemployed. So, you know, we were accused of lots of different things during the strike, you know, and I remember, you know, people saying to us, you know, we've a thing for black men and, you know, we're only doing it because, you know, we were silly young girls and we didn't know any better. I guess we did.
Yeah. I suppose, Liz, you were only 17 when you have commented that this experience did change your life.
Yeah, no, it did. It was only my first job. I was only, I think, 3 months employed by Dunn's. I was part-time. I didn't know any of the strikers. So when we came out, I think Karen was completely shocked to see that I was coming with them. But I have to say, I was just very naive at 17. I never knew about racism in Ireland. So when we were on strike and we encountered people and their criticisms of us and the way they spoke about black people, it horrified me, because I thought, you know, Irish people were always being classed as a really nice race of people and accepting, but it was an eye-opener when I came out on strike, I have to say.
I just want to ask Mary, they came up to you with the fruit. I mean, was that a moment for you when you went, oh God, no, it's me, the coin has landed with me, I'm going to have to do this? And how did your families take it? Because not everybody was on board with this. I mean, the vote went out to other shops and they didn't come out in solidarity with you. So you were very much the front line and on your own on the front line. I mean, you had administrative support from the union, but you didn't have membership support from the union. How did that affect you in your everyday lives?
I suppose, well, when as Karen said, when the woman was coming towards me, I was gone, please don't come to me. And when she did, I thought, oh, fuck her, here we go. So so it was more kind of, we were all refusing to handle the goods. So it was a matter of time, because the management had put managers behind us all on the picket, on the registers, to make sure that we were going to be refused. And if they were, when someone was caught. So it was only a matter of someone being caught, really.
So they were literally standing over your shoulder.
Literally, yeah. And literally had put us all on registers. They had brought us up over a couple of days beforehand and said, and asked us continuously, were we going to continue the boycott. And when we said, yeah, that day, they put us all on registers, the people who had said that they were.
That took some grit to do.
Yeah, but
with them standing over you, watching your every move, knowing where you were going to end up, you were going to end up outside the place, and that was it.
Yeah. But you have to understand the climate in Dunstars at the time. For most of us, it was our very first job. We were very young, as Liz said, Liz being the youngest. But it was like you would nearly do anything to eager to please them. I mean, when the strike play last night, you heard about our uniforms, about pop socks, about if you wanted to go to the toilet, you had to ask for a relief. You might have to wait an hour. you might have to wait 2 hours. It depended when they could get someone to go onto your tail, so you could run up, how many flights of stairs is that?
Seven or eight flights
of stairs to go to the toilet, and then they'd be like, what kept you? You know, so that's the kind of thing, the treatment that we were getting as workers in the store.
And how did your families take this when you did this? I mean, this was a big move. It was public news almost immediately. It was public news. You were in the public eye pretty much straight away.
Mm. I think they were kind of in shock, to be honest. Yeah. And you also have to remember, I mean, we were not on strike because of pay conditions, even though all of that led to the strike. Like, that union instruction for us was like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
It was like, this is the final straw. We've done so much to try and improve the conditions that we're working on. I mean, before the strike happened, we would have had or tried to have meetings with local management, and Brendan would have been involved, Brendan Archibald would have been involved in those. Like, we had complaints of, there was 27 or 8 items of complaints on that list. So when we got the instruction, it was like, right, that's it. We're not giving in anymore to Dun Stores. So the strike happened, and then it gained some very little publicity kind of at the start. And our parents were sort of saying, but you're not on strike for, you know, money, conditions, South Africa's thousands of miles away, you know, all of that. They were actually really worried about us and worried about what was going to happen. And for a lot of cases for us, well, for myself, like, my father was working, but I was the only other one working in the house, bringing in some money, you know. So, and that all, you know, went towards the family, and a lot of us were like that as well. And then you had Vonnie, who was a single parent, who turned around and lost her house as a result of what was happening. So, you know, I mean, our parents were more worried than it was like, you know, sort of the cause that we were going out on. They were worried about what was going to happen to us
in the future. I think they just thought, what sort of impact could we make as young people?
And it was like, only a few.
Yeah. And there was so little of us. So what impact could we make by doing this?
As well as that, then, as we said before, the climate in 84 was, you were lucky to have a job.
Yeah.
So, like, the thing was, they were thinking, you're putting your job in jeopardy by going out on strike. And then you're going to be known as a troublemaker, which was kind of, that was the way that it ended up for a long time for us as well. But so I think it was, from my parents' point of view, that was the worry that they had. So,
how did you overcome this? When did you see a difference between this was, and as your parents pointed out, how you're going to make a difference? Well, we know that by 1987 you had made a profound difference. When did you know that you were going to make a profound difference?
I think it was when we met Nimrod's Jack came down to the picket line, and then things changed for us. Right, we weren't actually 3 weeks in the strike when Cathair Asmal said to us, we'd kind of made our point, now go back to work. And that was the Irish anti-apartheid movement, because what was happening was he was losing control over his anti-apartheid movement in Ireland. And when that happened, we were very fearful of what was going to happen, and we had started changing our attitude towards the instruction. It wasn't an instruction anymore, it was like, this was something really passionate in it. And I think the real, as in publicity wise, was meeting Desmond Tutu in London, when myself and Mary went to meet him with Brendan Archibald and Don Mullins. And that was a turning point, because it was localised, and we were on strike for nearly 6 months at that stage. And the support that we were getting was from the solid, we say, left of people out there. And it was gone very sort of dead a bit. And then Tutu got the Nobel Peace Prize and asked to meet us. And that sent it across the world. So that was when the turning point, as in getting real recognition for what was happening in South Africa, turned.
I think as well, when,
Marius.
Marius, there's some people that made a big impact on us. And when we were on the picket line, we started to learn what was going on in South Africa. So it did become more than just a piece of paper. And I think when we met Bishop Tutu as well, what he did was, people were saying to us, you're going to hurt the black people of South Africa. And the church were against it. The church were openly speaking out against the strike. So we were meeting a man who was collecting his Nobel Peace Prize, who was a black man, who was a man of the church as well. So it kind of, people couldn't argue that argument anymore. So that's kind of a big turning point for us.
Yeah, and I'll just go back to what Bernadette said. I mean, there will always be people who line up and say, you're doing this wrong, you should be doing it this way, you should be doing it, you're damaging your own cause. How did it feel when you knew that the way you were doing it was the only way to do it, the right way to do it, and the way that was effective?
I think it felt great when we knew we were doing it the right way. Before we went to South Africa, Kadra Azmal was telling us that we were breaking the boycott and going to South Africa. We'd been invited to South Africa by Bishop Tutu and the South African Council of Churches. We weren't going to Sun City, or we weren't going anywhere nice. You know, it wasn't a holiday. We were going at the invitation of Bishop Tutu. And I think when we were refused entry into South Africa, well, we got as far as the airport lounge, and when they put us back on the plane, and when we eventually got back to Dublin, there'd been a state of emergency declared, and when we got into the airport, into Dublin Airport, Kadra Azmal was there, and I remember saying to him, well, do you still think we made the wrong decision in going to South Africa? And it was like, from then on, because of the state of emergency, because people were risking their lives to see what was coming out of South Africa, you know, what was happening in South Africa, people became more aware. It was more on the news, more from the outside world as well, wasn't it? Yeah. Where we would have got support. And we knew then, you know, we can't stop now. We have to keep going, like.
And when you were refused access to South Africa, you were described as the most dangerous.
He look it, don't he?
For me, I think that was the turning point of the strike. I think we gained a hell of a lot more support because people were thinking, why are these young people being deported back and not allowed in? So I think they made it worse for themselves by not letting us in the country. If we'd have gone in, we'd have just saw and we'd have came back out, no one would have known we were there or when we came out. But the fact that they stopped us just opened up a whole new, like, the media was all over us. As soon as we stepped off the plane, it was worldwide news.
Great.
So everyone then knew what we were about, because all the people that used to come to the picket line weren't sure why we were out. Is it that we didn't like black people, so we didn't want to handle their produce or what? But it opened everyone's eyes. For me, I think
that's great.
It was the turning point.
It's the more you stamp on it and a third, the bigger mess you make, and they really did make a bigger mess.
Oh, they did. They did. Yeah, they done us a favour.
Yeah,
they definitely done us a favour.
At what stage? I'm going to use the phrase, and I don't want you know. It's purely mine, but I believe political policing would be how I believe some of the visits from special branch could be kindly depicted. At what stage did that become an issue?
I suppose after the first few months, the police, it was actually quite interesting because there was actually a South African sergeant that was transferred to Store Street.
Okay.
And he took over the looking after of the strike. So the police started to have more of a presence on the picket line. And when ICTU gave us the all-out picket, then other member trade unions wouldn't pass the picket delivery. So they brought in Murray's, which used to take their rubbish away, which was a non-unionised company. And they started bringing in the goods. So they would go to whoever was the supplier to collect the goods and bring them in. So the picket started moving. They used to do that after 6 o'clock because that's when we had the most amount of people around. Mm-hmm. So we started doing all-night pickets. And that's when the police really started to get involved in it. And there was quite... They were very violent towards us. Mm-hmm. Do you know? I mean, especially Tommy. Like, he got an awful hiding from the police. Alma's finger was nearly ripped off because of them dragging. And I mean, at one stage, the management inside, we were sitting on the back door where the shutters came up, and there was about seven or eight of us. Mary Haid was there as well.
Yeah.
And they pulled the shutters down, and police were inside and outside, and we were kicked in the back and trapped in the shutters. So it wasn't all sort of, we were like plodding up and down the picket line, and it was lovely, and we had a great time. That wasn't the case of the strike.
It was hard.
It was really tough. I mean, the first year, this sounds mad, but that was horrendous.
which is always that funny thing now where we see now modern people are tone policing protests. Oh, can you protest on your day off? Can you protest? Can you not make a scene? Can you do this? And you're like, well, that's not actually protest. And the only way to make people uncomfortable, back by very definition, to make power uncomfortable is to act out. At any stage, though, all the way through that, did you just become more determined, or did it become an issue for you all that you had to sit down and talk amongst yourselves to say, do we keep going?
I think, and if I'm wrong in this, please come in. Well, I wouldn't have stopped you ever before. So. There was at never a stage that we were ever, any of us, going to go back and handle South African produce. That never came in. There were stages where we thought we would have to lift the picket, especially when the INLA decided to put a bomb in the shop. Remember, there was an incendiary device somewhere. So that we really did have to consider lifting the picket at that stage. We did consider, do we have enough? But we never considered ever handling South African produce.
I believe it was yourself who said our battle is nothing to what their battle is. If you put that in context, and again go back to most of the theme of most of the day has been solidarity, but this is solidarity in action. Has this had a profound impact, you know, 1984, 1994, 2000, here we are 35 years later. Exactly. But I mean that in a way that, because now when you see where we are as a country, we see the need for it more than ever. Has the story lost motion? Now, I know this room is filled with believers, but, you know, are we getting it out there enough?
No, we're not. I mean, you look at the room and it's great to see so many people here. There's no real young people here. No one. Except maybe Brendan's son. No, I'm serious. There isn't. So we're missing the opportunity. I mean, a year and a half ago, the Irish government tried to stop history being taught in schools. Mm. History!
Yeah.
Why is that? Why is that happening? Why do we have people that are coming into this country running away from terror and they're literally housed in a prison?
Yeah.
They cannot cook for themselves, they cannot work, they have a lousy 30 odd euros a week to survive. And that's 35 years on. How much has really changed in this country?
Yeah,
we've had the abortion referendum, brilliant. Same-sex marriage, brilliant. But we need to work on that. Mm. And we need to challenge ourselves.
As Tony pointed out, it's 35 years, and I have to say, absolutely aged great, the whole lot.
That envelope is for him.
That envelope is for him.
But do you find it disheartening? I mean, he stood on a point of principle. And a very important point of principle. And as you pointed out, it wasn't about wages, it wasn't about conditions. This was a bigger point of principle. Now, unions have moved away from being political. And by moving away from being political, they've lost the impetus on things like wages, work conditions. And unions are scrambling to catch up. Union membership is shrinking.
It's
dying on its feet. And as you said, in this room, there isn't enough young people in this room. There isn't. Do you find it disheartening?
I think, I think the importance, a couple of important issues that were mentioned earlier on as well, but I think it's important to try and get young people to vote as well. I mean, you look at the elections and the same people are getting voted back in time and time again, and they're not going to change anything. So we need to get younger people involved so they can vote and actually make a change. And at the end of the day, like, we are the union. The people who are the members of the union are the union. Union officials work for the union, but we're the union. So it's up to the people who are in unions to actually stand up and say, this is the direction we want to go in. So that's what I think, it's just to try and get people engaged and standing up and saying what their issues are.
And how do you think we should go about this? I mean, you're people who have actually been on the cutting edge. So how do you go about it? How do you mobilise people, motivate people, get them involved?
I think one of the things was people were motivated and got involved with the anti-water payments. They got involved with a number of the referendas. They were involved because it was an issue, right? And it wasn't party politics. It was an actual issue. And I do think what Bernadette said was that when you go in to talk to young people from a political party, you're selling your goods. You're selling where you're coming from, whether it's Sinn Féin, whether it's the Socialist Party, whatever it is, you're selling your goods. But what we need to educate people and young people is on the power of the ballot. You know, because you do have power. You know, if you are, and I think some sort of education programme whereby you're taught, you know, why people died to get a vote. You know, yeah. Like, you know, people died to give us the right to vote and why we should use that mm-hmm. for good. And I think one of the fundamental things that the trade union movement did was join social partnership. It was a disaster.
Absolutely.
An absolute disaster. And they sold us out. And they're continuing to sell us out by continuing the empowerment.
I don't have to completely agree with you. Partnership made unions lazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
They lost.
And it was the big boys. Yeah. It was the big men playing with the big men.
And then in 2007, 2008, when the crisis hit, unions were lifted up, put outside the door and told, we don't want to talk to you anymore.
Yeah, no. Let's all go down to Lansdowne Road and absolutely. Have a little powwow.
Absolutely, and that's what happened. And in a great degree, younger members were sold out by unions.
Yeah,
they were sold out by unions.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have teachers who are paid less.
Yeah.
We have GPs who are still underfunded. I mean, the American
two-tier system.
FEMPI exists for GPs. I mean, imagine that. That's incredible. It still exists. It's longer than rationing did after the Second World War. There are still emergency measures in place. Mm. And we're told there's a recovery. Mm. And we're told there's full employment. Yet we've never had higher homelessness. We've never seen nearly 4,000 children homeless in this country before. So how do we get unions? And as former union person John here pointed out, everybody's in a silo. Mm. Everybody's working for their own personal ends. How do you get some solidarity? He couldn't get it at the time. Has looking back given you some insight on how you get more solidarity out of people, how you get them involved?
I suppose people get involved in issues, they feel important, and it's making again, younger people see that these issues are important to us. Like homeless issue is just, it's crazy that in a country that has so many people who are supposed to be employed, there's so many people living on the street.
Yeah.
I mean, that just don't make sense. It doesn't make sense. But then it's the same thing again. The government are giving themselves raises and then letting, like, people are expected to live on, like, just the poverty line. So I think I think the young people we were young when the strike started. So I think it is important to get young people involved and get them excited about issues and get them like informed about issues that they can get behind.
I think to get young people involved in issues, you need wins. You need to show that you can win. Mm-hmm. And I think at the moment, our problem is that we can't show wins. Mm-hmm. We can't show, look, join a union, here's your win. Here's how you win. There isn't one solid issue out there. We can't make housing the issue simply because there's too many people too comfortable. So housing hasn't become the issue. Water became the issue because it affected everybody.
But if you look at the climate change at the moment, right, and you look at the streets when the protests are up, they're all young people, kids, right, that have a really good, valid message.
Mm.
And we have to ensure that our age group is starting to listen to them. Because, like, I mean, the bottom line is, we're actually on the way out. Right, we're the oldies now. I hate saying it, but we are.
We are.
And it's the young people. It's those kids on the street that are going to be voting in a year or 2 years or 3 years' time. They're the ones that are going to make the difference. I mean, who is the youngest person in the Irish Parliament at the moment?
Jack Chambers.
Yeah, how old is he?
105.
But you know what I mean? Like, yeah, emotion. But you know, like, there isn't anything to pull young people in, but there is an opportunity with climate change that if you can get them really involved in making the decisions on that, and we as adults ensuring that they get that choice and that chance, that we can then bring in other issues as well, that it's all part of a process.
It speaks to, again, something else was said earlier about joining the dots. Showing people that the activism for climate justice is actually activism for social change, better working conditions, more affordable housing, better standards of living. But there has to be a tipping point. And when you guys were on the getting basically spat at and called the worst names under the sun, that tipping point, I know you said it came in the departure lounge in South Africa, but it was a win. And Martin is right to point out there was a win. Do you see in the union movement any signs of green shoots for a union win on something at the moment? That's pretty telling, isn't it? I suppose then to bring that on to the next stage, you talked about the generational change. And that we need to almost, the phrase they use in America, which is an awful phrase, is pass the torch, you know?
Pass the torch.
But we do have to look at how these stories are remembered and how they're actually given and they're passed down. Because I know that, Martin, you were 26 at the time in 1984, so...
Yay! Older than we were.
You said to me on the way in that you were working in Dunn's, I think.
I was. I had my first job in Dunn's Stores at 14. I got the job a couple of weeks before you went on strike, and I was working at Dunn Stores in Portmarnock. Had just opened the hard streets of Portmarnock. It had just opened, and I got a part-time job there. And I do remember you going on strike, and I remember very hushed conversations. Nobody wanted the management to hear, and the general consensus is we can't. We'll lose our jobs. Mm-hmm. That was the general consensus. It wasn't out of a lack of solidarity. It was out of lack of fear. That people didn't. They were terrified to lose their own jobs. Now, that hasn't changed in 35 years. That hasn't changed. The support system when people do stand up still doesn't exist after 35 years. Now, we've got to ask ourselves why that is. Why is it that after 35 years, if somebody does make a principal stand, well, you're on your own, off you go, you're on your own. Any insights on that? Why do you think it stayed that way?
I think if you look at us, right, and you know, this weekend is all about celebrating what we did 35 years ago. It's really only in very, very recent times. I think really Mandela's death that we actually got any real recognition. When he came over and met us, we did get some recognition, but we were like, you know, the strike happened and we just disappeared, you know, because it suited the establishment to make us disappear.
Not only disappear, but we weren't allowed to get other jobs either. Yeah. It wasn't like the strike finished and we were all like, well done. Like, I went to Australia and I just wouldn't have got a job anywhere else.
Same, Karen Harm was
I got sacked after 13 months in Dunn's, and I won my own Fergus Smith's case, but I literally blacklisted. I couldn't get a job anywhere, so I had to bail out to Kerry.
Yeah, when you couldn't go to a new job and say your last place of employment, I was on strike in Dunn's for the last 3 years. I went up to community employment, and that was my way back into employment, and it was then I went to work in community.
As for me, as Dunn's was my first job, and I spent more outside than inside, it wasn't good on my CV. I was 3 months in and 3 years out. But when I went to look for another job like that, no one wanted to employ me. And I was 2 years looking for a job until my father said, enough is enough. So he got me a job in a hotel, lucky enough. So I got a job there and I worked there for a few years and then I left, because still I couldn't change from there to there because everyone knew who I was. So I ended up thought, right, I have to jump ship, literally.
She did.
Go to America. I went on a ship. And I left the country.
I did. I went back for about 2.5 years afterwards, and then I had my first child, and then I stayed at home. I didn't go back after that until later in life then, and I did a course then in childcare and got into childcare. But like that, you were kind of thinking, God, nobody's going to employ me because I'm classed as being one of the Dunstore strikers. So you thought you're never going to get a job. I actually remember asking Mary one time, I think, oh my God, you know, do they hound you? Where did you work? And, you know, they're going to keep hounding you, be on your back all the time. But yeah, it was very hard.
I do think it was. It wasn't until Nelson Mandela died and we were asked to actually represent Ireland at his funeral. That's for me, anyway, when I felt, well, everybody else now thinks that what we did was right. Yeah. At the time, they didn't. Like, I mean, a certain section of society did, but it wasn't until then that people actually started. And that was, what, 30 years later near?
I remember Ben Dunn telling me I'd never work in Ireland again. You know, I remember ringing him because I needed a form to say that I wasn't working in Dunn's anymore. And he goes, I guarantee you, you will never work in this country again.
And was he on the roof of a hotel?
No, that was before he went up.
So, you really went through an awful lot after the publicity died down. You were then on the blacklist. Mm-hmm. You were on the blacklist and I only spoke myself last week about blacklists within an industry, and they still exist to this day. They do still exist to this day. People who put their head above the parapet get shot down. Yeah. On a lot of these issues, I think that whistleblower legislation should apply. I think that people should have the same protections that whistleblowers. Now, they're not much, and they are not much, but it's better than nothing. And I think there has to be some protection scheme brought in there. Now, I know the minister has said in the last week that they're going to bring in protections for people who do come forward on other issues. But
like voting when you're not there?
No.
He was at a funeral in Kerry.
And like, well, it is great to see, and great to see. I mean, you look so well, and you've done such great work in Ireland. It is sad to see that the history of the movement has been lost. The history of what you did is not being taught in schools, and it was pivotal. Ireland played a huge part through ye.
But I do think that's twofold. I think one is the fact that we were working class, and the other is predominantly women. We were working class, predominantly women, and history is lost. You know, it's lost because of those two factors, you know. So it's really up to us to ensure that that sort of history isn't lost, you know, and that's really important.
You were asked, and in the play, it came up in the play, would you do it again? I know you were asked this question, and I know your answer to this. And I know your answer to this. When I ask you, anyway, would you do it again?
Yes, for sure. Yes.
And the caveat to that, would you expect better support and better solidarity if you did it today?
Yeah.
I think so. It would be a different strike today. I mean, you've got to remember that in 1984, no mobile phones, there's no emails, there's nothing for airway to get around. Like when we were ringing Brendan, we'd have to go to a public phone box to ring him. Like, so it's kind of, the world has changed a lot. So I don't know, but I don't know, a lot of people think that by saying they like something on Facebook that they're actually, you know, so I don't know whether it would have made it any easier or harder, to be honest with you. It would have been different, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think there's things that we might have done slightly differently, but like nothing that would have changed.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, you know, there is an opportunity at the moment of boycotting Israeli produce. And yes, the trade union movement is talking about it and, you know, playing some service to it. But I mean, there is an opportunity for something similar. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a workers' boycott. It can be a person's boycott. that they're asking all of their members. And I'm talking not just Mandate, because I know Mandate have done quite a lot of work. And I'm not just saying that because I've worked with David, right? But, you know, they have done some. But as ICTU, you know, like yesterday, you know, it's an opportunity for them to turn around and say, I'm asking all of our members on a personal level not to handle Israeli produce because of what's happening. You know, that's one way. And then, you know, you can build on that. But if we have that many members in the trade union movement in this country, like, lads, come on, things can change. And it is likely to, it is much different, as Mary said, like back when there was no mobile phones and we were running across to grocery stores and all that to ring Brendan or the GPO. But I don't think that the issues have changed fundamentally. It's still there. It's still the same issues. It's still the people in suits taking control. It's still the lads that own the buildings that are renting them out and that are holding on to them, and that people aren't able to buy houses and buy properties because you have developers who the government have enabled to do so.
Yeah.
I just want to say, thank you. Thank you so much for talking to us, but I do think you look like the most dangerous woman. No, I do.
I have no idea.
You are. And if people want to know what do dangerous people look like, they look like you. And that's what they look like. They look like people who are motivated, who have principles, who will stand up. And 35 years is a long time to be standing up. So all I can say on my behalf is thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Before we open up the floor, just I have to remind, there's a basket down the end for donations for Massey Ireland. Yeah, so if you're walking by and you're going out the door, throw some change. We prefer stuff that folds, if I'm honest. But
we asked the same question 35 years ago. We wanted money that folded.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I got just to South Africa. So there you go.
Issued £1 notes.
Todd, you're terrible.
But Jeff, have you any questions from the floor?
Which one? What is it? Oh, the lady in the corner. Just hold it a bit down from your mouth. Just
okay. Oh, perfect. Thanks so much to the panel. Oh, down. Okay. Thanks so much to the panel. You're all amazing. I wanted to ask a question about climate justice, because we know that climate justice. Do I need to speak up? Stand up? Okay. Oh, hello. I'm very small. It doesn't make much difference. Thanks to the panel. You're brilliant. And yeah, I wanted to ask about address the point about climate justice, because climate justice affects everyone. It affects the most vulnerable people the most as well. That's the real issue of climate change. So I'm involved in a few different environmental groups, and we really want to, in the environmental movement, we really want to work with the trade union movement and work with all the social justice groups. And I'm always hearing ideas from our side on how we can do it, but I want to hear from you guys and people in the room. How do we work together? How do we bring the movements together, energise or harness the energy of the school strikers, of the young people who are doing amazing mobilising? And what do you think we need to do right now, practically, to make this happen?
I think with anything, especially with climate change, I mean, that's something that affects every single one of us. I mean, and if we don't stand together on this, and I think it really is an opportunity to stand together, and for the trade union movement especially, to get off their backsides and get involved in it and support young people, because it's the young people that are coming forward with this. And force the likes of the Irish government and other governments to make real changes. You know, I mean, we're all already going to be fined I don't know how many millions, because yet again we haven't met our targets. Yet again the Irish government is going to put a carbon tax on the ordinary everyday workers, but we have the multinationals in this country that are paying a lousy 12% or 13% in tax. I mean, hello, what is going wrong? Because you have the likes of Leo Varadkar and his cronies that are all middle class
people. That are controlling this, because they want to be in the pockets of the multinationals. So they will sit down and they will turn around and say, well, okay, lads, you won't have to pay too much corporation tax, so we'll just stick another couple of percentage onto the ordinary working class that can't manage to buy their own house in Dublin. So unless that changes, and that's where the trade union movement needs to come in and needs to really fight, and they need to get out of social partnership now.
I would add, just on the just transition piece, that there has to be this is the first generation of 25, 35 year olds in the history of the state that's worse off than their parents were at that age. And if we can't point that out and actually make that a saleable point to young people, and then make that a saleable point to unions as a way to attract young people into the movement, you've missed an opportunity there, because surely that should be more radicalising than anything else.
Yeah. Two
in the back.
If I could just point on that, it is great that EXOR are looking for unions to come on board, but that works both ways. If you're an EXOR, join a union. You know, it's that simple. Yep. If you want your union to be involved, join it. It is that simple. It's all about union membership. The more people that join unions, the more power unions have, and the more power you have to change stuff. So it works both ways. Unions have to work for EXOR, and EXOR have to join unions. It's as simple as that.
Just a couple of things. First of all, I think some of the analysis on the unions is a bit off, because the membership has gone down so much, so that's partially the reason why they're outside the door. And, you know, it's up to everybody, obviously, to try and up the membership. And as regards attracting youth, well, that's one of the things. One of the things that can be done by unions to attract youth is to get involved in things like climate change. The problem is we are involved in the unions, but there's not enough publicity about it, and there's not enough people on the ground. I can't remember who it was. Somebody up on the platform said about the union as the members, not the hierarchy. And that's what we have to keep remembering, that it comes from the grassroots. It doesn't have to come from the top. And, you know, if you push the door often enough, if you're on the bottom, well, then you'll get in the door, and that's it. On the climate change thing, in fact, some of the unions have gotten involved with the youth. And what they've said is, we will help you on your marches. We will not be the marchers. We will go out and we'll steward for you. We'll do all the liaison and whatever, because, you know, somebody 15, 16 in school doesn't know that you need a police permit and all these kind of things. So the unions said, we can give practical help, okay? So there's Congress Global Solidarity, and all of the unions have, most of them anyway, have a Global Solidarity unit they can get involved in. And we were talking about Palestine earlier on, and about boycotting Palestine. Trade union friends of Palestine are desperately trying to get people involved on boycott. And there has been since 2007, is it 2007, Anne? Policy on total boycott from ICTU. So the policy is there. It's just a matter of people knocking at the door and pushing it. So, you know, rather than us being totally negative, if we can get in there and start pushing, you know, the mechanisms are there. It's up to us to use them.
Okay, great. Here, yeah. One of the things we don't do well on the left and in trade unions, I suppose, is celebrate victories. And it's the reason we wanted to organise today and yesterday's event. And it's interesting, the discussion coming up. And just to touch on what the last speaker said as well, you know, the question was asked, when was the last victory we had? That Dunn strike was phenomenal. But we had another Dunn strike, if people can remember, in 2015. And some of you guys were on the picket lines and did showing our members how to picket, because they were just letting everybody pass and didn't understand the process of picketing. So it's something workers have to learn again. Yeah, but what I wanted to say was, we've got in this room as well, not up on the platform, but we've two of our strikers from that day here. Not only did they get victimised after the strike with having their hours slashed, all across the country, by the way, 6,000 Dunn's workers went on strike for the right to have secure hour contracts. We won. They won. They got legislation changed in March of this year. So now everybody after 12 months is entitled to a secure hour contract. So it's not that unions are ineffective or we're not doing anything about these things. It's that it's very hard to get that message out there. As a communications officer, it's probably my responsibility to get out there more than anybody. But we issued press releases about today's event. One newspaper article, no national media attention for this event. it's very hard for us to get those victories out there as well. And another one, obviously, I was a coordinator on the Right to Water campaign. That came from our democratic structures. Tesco worker in our town put forward a motion at our conference, April 2014, gave us the legitimacy to go out and campaign on water charges. And since that campaign, our members have saved €84 million in bills that they would have got. So there's another victory coming from a trade union campaign. So, I mean, let's not do down the trade union movement too much as well. Let's celebrate its victories as well as be critical of that, because I am probably more critical, and Karen will know this, I'm more critical than most of the trade union movement, but I do like to celebrate our victories as well.
This way. Okay. My name is Michael. I come from the African National Congress, which is the ANC.
And Rugby World Cup.
And I would have loved to put on my ANC attire, but I had to go to this match today, so that's why you see me. And it's the very Springbok that was boycotted here a few years ago. And it basically tells that times have moved on. But I also wanted to say that, and I felt I needed to be here because what these people have done needed to be acknowledged. You know, it should never be lost throughout, you know. So as a young man who was 19 years in 1984 when you're on strike, and now I live and work here and I have an Irish family, I felt you needed to see evidence of some of the things you've achieved. In other words, I'm saying what you fought for actually helped bring down apartheid. I had a question that I wanted to ask, whether you really understood what was apartheid. But somewhere you answered it halfway because you said you didn't even know how to spell it and all that. Because I was born in it. I've lived through it. I've faced it. I've looked it in its eyes. I know what it means. It's a terrible system. And I don't know if you're also aware that the apartheid regime, how vicious it was. You could have not even been sitting there. There's a lot of people who did what you did, and their graves are unknown. So that's how serious the situation is. I want to move further to the other issue of, say, you are unable to recruit, to get youth involved in the trade union movement. So I'm touching on a number of issues because it's quite a number of things. It's not easy. I can tell you the ANC is struggling to get the young people understand that the freedom that they achieved, many people died for, and therefore the youth must be involved. They don't understand. I had somebody saying that you need to explain to people that, look, a lot of people died for the vote, therefore you must get involved. I mean, look at, I'm just giving you a scenario where the ANC is trying to say, look, guys, this is very recent. People have died trying to get this freedom. Please get involved. It's not easy to deal with youth in that sense. You've got to talk to the youth. You've got to let them lead. It's usually known that in Africa, there's a lot of dictators in Africa who don't want to leave their positions. But you must look within the trade union movement. There's people who are holding on positions for too long. Give this youth the positions to lead. I'm just suggesting it's one of the ways to do it. If you think that you're just going to organize them and they come in as foot soldiers and they'll get interested in the trade, in trade unionism as time moves on, it might take you a century to achieve that. So get them involved. I think I'll leave it there. There's just one other thing that you raised there about, yeah, it's got to do with how you got involved yourself. It doesn't mean that they have to understand the whole trade unionism in full before they get involved. Because when you said how you got involved, you didn't have much clue of what you're doing, but you got involved, and here you've produced some results. So political education will help. Involving them, giving them position, giving them responsibilities, it will get the youth involved. We all need young people in all organizations, and it's not easy to achieve that. And just on a closing note, what you've done is great, guys. Thank you very much.
I'll just go down here first.
afternoon again. I'm going to talk about the play that I saw yesterday, because when you're sitting there and telling what happened is different when you see it on stage, different characters, how young you were, others were trying to save for the vacations, and others were single mothers, the pressure that you got and all that. That performance yesterday, it really made me see where you were and the struggle that you faced. It's different than when you're sitting there talking. There's no emotion. There's just words. They're just coming out. But seeing that small girl and, you know, playing around and all that, you can really visualize it and really feel it. Why I'm bringing this up, talking about young, the teenagers, the young ones that are coming up now, this is the language they know, entertainment. This story needs to be told the way it happened, not in big words, political words and all that. The same way it happened, the same clothing, the same, you said you were ignorant, the same feeling. This is the language that the youth know. This is the language that made me understand and appreciate and see you going through the struggles that you went through. If I didn't come yesterday and I just came here and I sat here and everybody's speaking English, maybe I would have dozed off halfway, I don't know. But the feeling that I got after watching the play, my children were there, the teenagers. They saw you, ladies. And when I was leaving the house this morning, we're like, Mom, what time are we going? I said, no, I'm going by myself today. And the youngest is, what, 13? And the twins are 15. And they were interested to come here today because of what they saw yesterday on stage. Use the language the youth know. This is how you get them on board. Thank you.
Just hold it down.
Okay, right, thank you. Yeah. Hello. First of all, I just want to make a personal confession. You've always been my heroes. You are my heroes. And you always will be my heroes. I have to say that. I'm glad that we have some fanatical South African rugby supporters here with us. It's very timely, actually, because today is the very first time that a black captain of a rugby team has raised the Webb Ellis Cup up in the air, you know, in triumph. But that's a great thing. That would have been unthinkable in 1984, absolutely unthinkable, you know. And, you know, to a certain extent, a lot of us simply unthinkingly accepted, blindly accepted the system in this country so far away, South Africa, you know.
Including the RFU.
Yes, including the RFU, absolutely. Yeah. But, what I really wanted to say, well, there was this, in praise of trade unionism and what happens, there's one thing which I think you showed extraordinary courage in that first year, because you suffered abuse not just from all sorts of different people, but from your own, as you understand it, work colleagues who were also trade union members of the said union that you were in, you know. Now, this is by no means the only example in disputes or conflicts where there would be a lot of conflict within the union as well, you know, and some of it very, very nasty, you know, and we shouldn't sort of just paste over that and say that doesn't happen, you know. I think we need to talk about things, warts and all, you know. And maybe you might just comment on that a little bit. You know, the other thing that came into my mind when you were talking was at Nelson Mandela's funeral when he died. And the next thing was Emma Gilmore was the Minister for Foreign Affairs at the time. You might remember. I'm sure you do remember. And the next thing I and everybody else in the country heard, he was going to represent us in South Africa at the funeral, you know. And now, I don't know whether you know this or not, but there were legions of people, including myself, who rang him or rang his secretary, who sent emails, who did all sorts of things, saying, no, Eamon, stay at home and send the Dunstore strikers instead. There was, you have no idea of the numbers of people. And it just struck a primal chord in people, you know, that the great, fantastic work that you did was registered, is registered, you know, in an awful lot of people's minds and hearts and souls, you know. And I want you to know that. Okay, that's just it.
Just hold it at chest. Well, it's actually probably already been kind of said, but I'm in absolute awe of you. Like, I didn't really know. I wasn't born when the strike started. Sorry. But I, even still, I you know, I probably heard the name, but I didn't really, until Dave, kind of had conversations with Dave, I really didn't know much about it. And I'm actually finding quite emotional just sitting here listening to you. But even looking at the poster and kind of what that lady just said there as well, like, I can just see that this being a massive film. You know, I'm like, how? And the same way, like, how do we not learn this in history? I just think this is absolutely massive. And I think it's on a par with the lockout. And, well, yeah, you don't need to tell me, yeah. But, like, has anybody ever approached us to make a film? Like, is this... Yes. Is there? Okay.
Yeah, there's some discussion that's happened, and hopefully something will come out with that. But I suppose, like, in fairness to Tracy, she was kind of the first person to come on board to tell our story, and I suppose things have somewhat developed since then. But look, we're in discussions. We don't know if it's going to happen or not, and we'll just have to watch this space.
Just on the younger people as well. In the last 2 or 3 years, I've had about probably 5 or 6 Leaving Cert students who've asked me to could they interview me as part of for their history projects. So I think the young people are starting to kind of, I mean, don't let me classes history opinion. But there you go. But it is kind of, you can see where young people are starting to kind of get an interest in asking about and realising about the strike.
We're definitely getting old.
Yeah. I think we're all getting a little bit older, but what you did is history, and you are living history. And I'd just like everybody to stand and give a round of applause, please.